You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Welcome to the DMZ, everyone. It's a Christmas week holiday edition.
Let me be the first to be politically incorrect on the show and to wish you a Merry Christmas.
I think I was already politically incorrect by just referencing Christmas, but right back at you, my friend.
I mean, it was dangerous. I'm a little nervous to do it. I don't know what the repercussions are going to be. I mean, granted, I'm in my private home right now, but the NSA might be listening. And if this gets leaked to the universe, my reputation might be permanently damaged. But I'm gonna take the chance in the name of proper etiquette and wish you Merry Christmas one more time.
Thank you. And there is a war on Christmas, and I hope everyone will get in their pajamas, drink hot cocoa, and talk to their family about Obamacare this holiday season.
Not a bad idea, actually.
All right. Well, man, I've still been on the go since getting back from Vegas, but lots of stuff are happening. You know, I was on. Thank you, Bill. Bill, you were my secret weapon. I was on Fox News doing post Democratic debate coverage right after Saturday night at like 11 o'clock at night, and we were texting back and forth. You were giving me tips on what to watch for. And I normally cover the right on politics, but this was a fun little foray into the Democratic Party.
Now, have you watched the other Democratic debates? Is this the first one you actually watched all the way through?
Oh, it's definitely the first one I've watched all the way through.
In my life. You're steeped in the Republican race for the year. You spent a good deal this year writing your book, exploring the ins and outs of what ails the Republican Party. You know, is there a certain culture shock that you get? You're getting, you know, 2 hours of Democratic / socialist rhetoric, you know, mainline to your veins. Your eyes forced open like Clockwork Orange. And what is that? Do you feel like you're in a whole other universe when that happens?
No, you know, the biggest thing, my sort of biggest big picture takeaway, and I've heard other people make this observation, but frankly, it was how, politics is changing. And so the partisan divides aren't as stark as the kind of populist divides. So you had Bernie Sanders talking about, you know, foreign policy intervention. Bernie Sanders basically saying the same stuff that Ted Cruz and Donald Trump say. And you have Hillary Clinton basically saying the same stuff that Marco Rubio says. And
we texted about this a bit, you know, during the debate show. And I wouldn't say I'm quite surprised that it's not getting more attention, but to me, that actually was the biggest substantive news of the debate, that you had both Bernie Sanders and Maren O'Malley criticizing Hillary Clinton and implicitly Barack Obama for, one, intervening in Libya and being part of the ouster of Gaddafi, and two, essentially saying we should leave Assad in place in Syria for now. You know, they didn't go quite as far as say they should stay there, they should stay there forever. But by saying you want to keep them there in the short term is basically saying you want to keep them there indefinitely. And that's a pretty big difference between where Hillary and Obama are and where...
But it's exactly the same thing that Ted Cruz was saying and Donald Trump and the Republic. Mainly, I mean, I think Trump is probably the farthest out there. But Cruz was the one who was making a big deal out of it. I mean, he and Rubio had a pretty significant back and forth over this issue, and Cruz was trying to make hay by comparing Rubio to Hillary. Fair point, but Cruz is like a socialist. Bernie Sanders, I mean, by the same token, it's very interesting how the Republican Party has changed in so many ways. And just one example would be Donald Trump. Very recently, you know, he got the endorsement of Vladimir Putin.
And which he accepted. That's the strange thing.
Put aside the fact that if you were a conservative Republican back in my day, you were very anti-communist and you hated Russians. And I realize the Soviet Union doesn't exist, but Putin was a KGB agent. But let's put that part aside. The interesting thing is that Joe Scarborough said, well, you know that Putin kills journalists. And Trump says, well, believe me, we kill people too. We kill lots of, you know. And the moral equivalence of that's something that like Michael Moore or somebody from the left would say that, well, yeah, Russia did some bad things, but America kills people too.
Like a Noam Chomsky left. Let's not tar the entire left with that kind of thinking.
That's a fair point.
You do hear some sort of stuff like that out of a strain of the left.
I'm making notes because I'm gonna use that Noam Chomsky line because I may end up writing about this.
I thought that, I mean, you know, Trump said a lot of things that we think are weird and beyond the bounds of normal politics, but that struck me as being not all that bright to do within the confines of a Republican primary. Now, what Cruz is doing, I see a bit more logic to, because you know, while there is certainly overlap between what Cruz said and what Bernie Sanders said as far as keeping Assad around, the underlying motivations are still ideologically different. You know, Cruz is basically saying we should do what's in our national interest. It's more of a John Bolton type conservative foreign policy. Whatever's good for America, we should do. Who cares about the ideological or philosophical principles? Who cares about democracy here?
Whose principle did you say that was reminiscent of?
John Bolton.
Okay.
Yeah, but Bolton, I think, is mischaracterized as a neocon. He's much more of a national interest conservative than an ideological, philosophical neocon.
Have you seen how Cruz has been getting criticized for, like, using the word neocon, neoconservative, to attack Rubio, I think? Mm-hmm. And he said a few things. One was like America first, mm-hmm. which harkens back to, you know, sort of anti-Semitic isolationists. And then there was another one.
You can use that in 92.
There was another one. There's another line that Cruz used that it wasn't. You know how it is. You can't say. And then the final solution is, I mean, there's certain like terms that get
associated with. Cruz said in terms of immigration, he's against legalization yesterday, today, and tomorrow.
That's what it was.
Harken back to George Wallace, segregation today, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever. You know, I mean, all these things, like, he's not literally.
But it's also an Elvis song, too, in fairness. I Googled it, and yesterday, today, and tomorrow is also like an Elvis song. So, I mean, do you think he's intentional? I mean, he's a smart guy. Is he intentionally? Is this a dog whistle, or is this just happenstance?
In the terms of the immigration one, I wouldn't assume that was intentional. I think he's more just had his back against the wall with his "I do not intend to support legalization." He wanted to be definitive about it. The American first thing is a bit weirder, but again, it's not. You may be going a step too far to say you are intentionally trying to be anti-Semitic. You're intentionally trying to appeal to segregationists. You know, you might get called out for being overly sensitive or politically incorrect or all that, politically correct, all that kind of stuff. But it certainly it shows, at minimum, a lack of care in rhetoric. You know, the kind of thing that might burn you if you were actually the nominee and competing in the general election. But I think Cruz at least is articulating a view that I think even if you can be a conservative and disagree, but it's rooted in some conservative principle as far as rule of law, American national interest, all that sort of thing. You know, Trump being pro-Putin really is not in line with anything on any side of the fence. Whereas, you know, Bernie and Syria is in the line of a longstanding, you know, left quasi-isolationism, which says let's not get distracted by foreign adventurism and distract from our needs at home, lifting up the poor, income inequality. Let's not waste our blood and treasure on stuff that's not our business. So I still think, you know, Bernie and Cruz are coming at it from different places, even though their endpoint is overlapping. Then this is why there's been foreign policy divides among the Democrats and Republicans for a century, because where you stand in foreign policy does not neatly dovetail in what you feel about domestic policy and the role of government and all that sort of thing.
Well, but for the last you know, quarter of a century, it pretty much has, right? I mean, wouldn't you say that during most of our political lives, that was a where you stood on, like, your level of hawkishness was indicative of your level, your partisan identity?
Well, we've had a situation where, you know, post-Vietnam, that the party reputations have been Republicans are hawks and Democrats are doves. And there is some truth to that, of course, but it obscures the fact that the consistency of Democratic interventionism, albeit often more on, you know, human rights grounds than national interest grounds, goes back to Wilson. Wilson, FDR, Truman, Kennedy, LBJ, Clinton and Bosnia, and now Obama with Libya and with ISIS. There hasn't been a McGovernite liberal anti-war Democrat who's ever been elected president in the last 100. Well, you know, Jimmy Carter would be the closest. That Jimmy Carter didn't actually intervene military anywhere, so maybe you can put him there. But he is clearly the exception.
All right. Well, let me just run through this little informal list. I'm checking twice here. I'm keeping this list and I'm checking it twice. Now, these are things I signed up for as a conservative. So I signed up to be pro-life, and yet Ann Coulter says she doesn't care if Donald Trump performs abortions as long as he keeps Mexicans out or illegals out or deports them or whatever. I signed up for free trade, but now we're not for that.
Well, most Republicans in Congress voted for fast track, so it's not, you're okay there. You're just not okay with Trump.
I signed up for a small welfare state, or to roll back the welfare state, or to, you know, basically at least means test. And now you can't be for that. That's bad. Now we're for, now we're, we want to keep government's hands off our Social Security. So we're, that's, we like big entitlement programs now. We do not want to reform, even to reform them. Maybe we want them to collapse. Maybe that's the trick. I don't know. I think the national security one is really interesting, because I'm of an age, Bill, where that was a sort of defiant, you know, you hated the Russians. You know, it's funny. One of my best friends is Armenian, and when he was a kid, he was always fighting the Turks. Like, I was always fighting the Vietnam War, like in my backyard, you know what I mean?
Right.
With plastic guns. And he was fighting the Turks. I feel like there's a coming of age moment where you're locked in to certain people you hate. And the Russians were certainly, if we learn nothing from Rocky IV, they were the existential enemy. You know, I'm locked into that, maybe. And maybe I need to be more open-minded. I mean, because they're white, and because they're nominally Christian now. I mean, I know the Soviets were atheists. And because supposedly they want to take on ISIS, maybe we need to be best friends with them. Maybe I'm hung up on distrust of Russians. Maybe that's a problem. Maybe I've like aged out, you know. It's time to ship me off, Bill.
Well, I think there are three places you can be here. There's sort of the Mitt Romney place. Russia is our number one threat, and we should oppose them and try to defeat them geopolitically.
They're like the Klingons, Bill. You can't trust them.
Right, right. There's Donald Trump, and it's not just Donald Trump. We've seen other conservatives, you know, tout Putin favorably in contrast to Obama. You know, this is a real leader. And even, you know, Pat Buchanan has praised Putin on being a bulwark against gay rights. Is Putin the last conservative leader? So there is that strain out there that likes Putin on the merits, on social issues and as firmness of executive power, and being an ally against ISIS. There's that, and I think there is a middle ground there, which I would say where Obama is, which is more case by case. Let's oppose Putin on Ukraine, but let's be clear-headed and say we need to work with him if we want to solve the Iran deal, which did work, you know, to the extent the you may not like the Iran deal, but the fact is he got the deal that he wanted by working with Russia. And now Kerry is taking the next step and meeting with them over Syria and saying, can we come up with a peace process where we ease Assad out over time and get Russian and Syrian cooperation versus ISIS, which is what we desperately need. So, you know, if you're taking the Mitt Romney view, you don't even have that kind of olive branch reach out to see where is the common ground. If you're Donald Trump, you don't even make any kind of noise about what's going on in Ukraine. You might let Ukraine go altogether because who cares? It's not my problem. It's someone other country, and Putin's a good guy, so whatever. But that's sort of where I think the Russia, you know, argument stands right now. And it's to some degree healthy for both parties to have a reassessment after 8 years of Bush, after 7 years of Obama. Various foreign policy theories and tactics have been tried. It's probably worth a reassessment in saying what works and what doesn't. Certainly, I think it's in the Republicans' interest to not just cling on to the Bush theory of intervention to the bitter end, because that didn't work very well. I think on the Democratic side, what I saw in the debate on Saturday, I was sort of pleased to have a substantive disagreement to talk about. I thought what Bernie and O'Malley were saying about it was very superficial. Just sort of equate, trying to take out Assad and Gaddafi with taking out Saddam Hussein. I think they're just totally different situations. And Bernie lumped them all together. Hillary's for regime change, which is clearly meant to yoke her to Bush and Iraq. And in both cases, in both Iraq and Syria, this is not, we want to knock off a guy to put in a guy that's more favorable to us. In both those cases was, there's a rebellion coming from the ground that's going to lead to great instability if we don't do something to aid it. We cannot, if we have a strong man executing genocide, that's not healthy for the world. If we have a power vacuum where terrorism thrives, that's not healthy for the world. So I thought O'Malley and Bernie were taking kind of cheap shots there, which I don't like. But having the discussion is a good thing.
All right. So two quick points. First, I've already gotten several emails from angry Trekkies who point out that the Klingons and the Federation form an alliance. Not really, because I only care about the original show with Captain Kirk, James T. Kirk. That's where it ends for me.
Let me say, Matt, we are in full agreement there. There's only one Star Trek.
Thank you. The other thing I would say is, so if Cruz, or especially if Trump is the nominee, which is within the realm of possibility, he could run against Hillary from the left. And if you want to call it the left, right? I mean, he could, Donald Trump could attack her for being a neoconservative, regime changing adventurist, if that's a word, and he could advocate a humble foreign policy. That would be bizarre, right?
Certainly bizarre in terms of national politics. We haven't seen that kind of jiu-jitsu in a while. You might see more of that kind of cross-pollination at the state level. But I am more sanguine than you that Trump will not be the nominee. If Trump ran third party, I could see him trying to stake out that turf and talk about that more than he is right now and pick up
Believe
more
me,
on
Hillary
the left.
Was wrong. I mean, he would talk about Hillary's vote on the Iraq War, and he would claim that he would claim he never supported it, or that he opposed it way back in 2003.
This is why the Republicans shouldn't be, you know, dancing around Trump, worried that if we're too mean to him, he'll run third party and split our vote. He's going to run differently as a third party candidate. He would do a more overt appeals to the left in that situation. So I think they're better off now saying, look, this guy is not one of us. We're not going to invite him to the debates. He is beyond the pale, and we don't want him being treated like the spokesperson for our party.
I don't want to go down this this rabbit hole. I think we've had this discussion before, but I'll just say, my brother-in-law, and I've got three of them, so I won't, so this shouldn't give away too much, but one of them is supporting Trump. And my point being that there are a lot of, there are a lot of sort of regular conservative Republicans out there who are supporting him. And if you do that to him, then I think he becomes a martyr. It's perceived as unfair, and you lose them.
So do you? And so you've had some personal conversation with your brother-in-law. Is he Trump do or die, or
I haven't talked.
Or do you think he's just having some fun?
I've already
right now
divulged too much, but no, I'm hearing this secondhand. We have not had the.
Okay.
This might be a Christmas. This might be a discussion that we have around the. There really could be a pajama boy moment, where I will, instead of healthcare reform, I'll be asking him, "What the hell are you thinking?"
But you were telling me before we started talking that you are actually concerned that Trump will be the nominee, that your party has left you. But you sort of, we say this before, that the party has sort of gone left in all these things. Do you really think, I mean, you know your party better than I do. You're in the midst of it and I'm not. Your sense is that the party has been fully Trumpized and all is lost.
No, I don't think all is lost, and I don't know. We've been wrong about so much. It's always hard to predict anything. Who predicted Santorum would win Iowa last year? So I don't know that Trump is going to win, but it wouldn't surprise me. It is within the realm of possibility that Trump will win. And I think that there are a lot of people out there who have just sort of given up, and he's pushing all the right buttons. He's the right man at the right time. I don't think this would have worked a decade ago, but I think he's tapping into some deep-seated stuff. It's the zeitgeist. And I think there is an appeal, and there's a question as to whether or not some people argue that he's actually underrepresented in the polls, despite the fact that he's already dominating a lot of polls. That supporters are he's underrepresented. I don't know if you saw this, Bill, but the theory is, they've seen this in other nationalist populist parties around the world, but they underperform on telephone polls because this would be attributable to the fact that it appears that Trump supporters are non-college educated. The theory is that the college educated supporters of people like Trump won't tell you. They're ashamed to say that they're supporting Trump, but deep down they're like, yeah, man, we got to do something about this stuff going down. Trump's, I don't like Trump. He's a son of a bitch, but he's our son of a bitch. And, I don't want people to know that I'm supporting Trump, but someone's got to clean this stuff up. Someone's got to take care of business. And, you got to break some eggs to make an omelet. You know what I'm saying? I'm going to pull the lever for him.
We've seen that dynamic in some other races in history, particularly when the alternative is someone who's not white. We've seen that kind of dynamic before. But my sense of it right now is there isn't in Republican circles, there isn't a social stigma for backing Trump right now. Trump is the toast of the town. Trump gets all the press.
No, there
Trump's
is.
Rallies
Bill,
are huge.
There is.
That's
why the dichotomy would be. That is why he would be underperforming in the polls amongst a certain class of more highly educated Republicans.
I think the dynamic is the opposite
theory
right now, which is everyone's having a giant keg party for Trump right now, and the hangover is going to come a month or so from now, and the polls will fall. People seem to be sort of extra excited.
You're not going to the same Georgetown cocktail parties.
I feel like listen, it's like Trump is losing in the polls right now. Trump is winning in the polls amongst Republicans.
That's the point, is that he may actually be winning by a bigger margin. Now, the other side of it is, will his people actually caucus? You know, will they actually, the people who, so I think it's simultaneously, not simultaneously, but you could argue, this is like a Schrodinger's campaign type situation. You could argue persuasively that Trump is either being overrepresented in polls because they're not going to actually show up. They're not likely, historically likely voters, or that he's being underrepresented based on the theory that I was just talking about here, about people not telling phone operators. So this is showing up in online polls, but not on phone polls, is the theory. And some smart people that I know subscribe to this theory.
I mean, I go with the former, in part because we've had evidence that his ground game is not up to snuff. He hasn't put the energy into it. That we've seen reports in the Des Moines Register, for example, that they go to his caucus training events, and you get a lot of people there who haven't been in politics before and seem unnerved by the notion, oh, I have to go knock on doors now? I got to talk to my neighbors? I don't want to do that. But because you're attracting people who are just reacting to who's kicking up the most dust in the media, and not people who are actually committed caucus or primary voters who have sat down, you know, a few days before voting, saying, okay, it's time to get serious. Who's going to go vis-a-vis Hillary? Who's going to be the best chance to win? Let's get real now. And we're already seeing, I mean, granted, you know, Trump's had some sags, and then he bounces back up because he says something crazy and stays in the media. That's sort of the PR genius of Trump. I grant him that. But we are seeing in Iowa a pretty big shift to Cruz right now. So at minimum, not that I think Cruz will be the nominee either, but it does show that the Trump party, people are starting to say, okay, that was a fun show. We had a good season. We have 6 or 7 good episodes of campaign Trump. Now let's move on to the serious business of actually voting for someone that I think could win.
Right. Okay. So I think Ted Cruz wins Iowa, and then that means that Donald Trump doesn't win Iowa, which means Donald Trump is a loser. And your theory, and it's plausible, is that once the facade of Trump's being omnipotent and omniscient and a winning, you know, tiger blood, once that is punctured, that he will then collapse. And maybe you're right, but it also sounds like wishful thinking as well, as wish casting. We don't know that that's going to happen. It's a theory. It's sort of the last best hope we have left. But and perhaps it's true. Perhaps that's what happens. He loses Iowa to Cruz, and then it goes, and then he loses New Hampshire to Christie or Rubio, and now he's lost twice. And he slinks off into obscurity, or back to NBC, or wherever people like Trump slink off to.
If there was a race, if the state after Iowa was South Carolina, you know, where Gingrich won in 2012, you know, maybe I'd say, okay, maybe there's a place that Trump could recover quickly. I mean, I still would probably say no, because, you know, the Trump juggernaut is, I mean, he's a hype man. Anytime you attack him, he says his answer is, well, my polls are up, so I must be right. So once he loses that argument, and that's basically his defense shield for almost anything that comes his way. So that's a huge, huge, huge problem for him. But New Hampshire in particular is really poor ground for Trump. You know, New Hampshire has a big history of going moderate. You know, they went for McCain, they went for Romney.
South Carolina has a history, believe it or not, of going moderate. People think of it as this, you know, Southern Christian state, but it was the Bush firewall. And
but they ran hard to McCain's right to dispatch McCain.
Okay, but fair point. But it's usually South Carolina picks the winner, and usually that's not the most concerned.
Well,
didn't Gary Bauer and Pat Buchanan run that year too? I mean, or not Pat Buchanan, but Steve Forbes. I mean, there were other people in that race besides George W. Bush. I mean, my point is that I think South Carolina, because Newt, I mean, there's the image, you know, that it's this Southern right-wing state, but there's more moderate voters than you might think.
Well,
Lindsey Graham is a senator from South Carolina.
That's true, and I think generally speaking, the Republican primary electorate is more moderate than we think at this stage of the game, because people who are more rabid are showing up at events and getting goosed by talk show hosts and goosing people in the polls. But the voting populace expands dramatically once you get out of these first few states. But New Hampshire, because in large part independents can play. And New Hampshire independents have been a more moderate lot, and I think they will probably be less likely to participate in the Democratic side because that race is less dramatic. I don't see Trump being able – I would think New Hampshire is going to look at Cruz winning Iowa and say, okay, that's not a good way to go. We don't want to give Cruz like a giant launch pad into the nomination. We got to put a brake on that. And whoever's going to seem the more electable alternative to Cruz would get the leg up. Now, there's a risk that they can't decide who that is, and it splits between Rubio and Jeb and Christie and Kasich.
But the asterisk here, Bill, the other complicating factor, and I'm not saying you're wrong, but the complicating factor is that Donald Trump performs best amongst like secular, liberal, and moderate Republicans.
Well, I think he has some support
aside
there.
Particularly
in the Northeast. I grant that. I mean, he polls well in Massachusetts. I mean, he's very akin to Howie Carr, who's the local Rush Limbaugh here. So I agree. He has a Northeast constituency that should not be ignored. And Pat Buchanan, you won New Hampshire in 1986, but with a very small percentage, with about 26%. So I think Trump could, in that sense, make it hard for Cruz to consolidate the right in New Hampshire. But I think if the establishment can really consolidate around one alternative to Cruz, I don't think Trump gets to sneak in there. But that to me is the big wild card. Right now, Rubio has sort of the leg up in that establishment race. But if he can't really, and he's trying to, we've talked about he wants to peak at the right time. So if he pulls that off and he peaks at the right time, he would get it. My being a Jeb man, as you know, I think a lot of bricks are going to come down on Rubio in January, and everyone's kind of laying off Jeb right now, and that's why I think he can make his stand in New Hampshire, as Politico noted today. Politico,
are you talking about New? Are you predicting a Jeb comeback, New Hampshire?
I mean, I'm on record saying Jeb's going to be the nominee. If Jeb can have a very strong New Hampshire showing, now maybe if not winning, if you can do like a Bill Clinton 1992 and be the close second and sort of make the cut going forward, that would probably be enough for him to, because that would be Jeb back from the dead. Jeb's the comeback kid. I mean, I think he could probably go on there.
Good news. The Hill reports Bush grabs former Graham supporters after 2016 exit. Jeb could be up to 4% in the polls if that happens, if he gets 100% of Lindsey Graham's support. So
there's a sense that not just Graham, but John McCain and Kelly Ayotte, the New Hampshire senator, that the three of them could endorse as a block. And while Graham was polling at zero, so in and of himself, he doesn't bring you very much. McCain still has a constituency, even if it's not the hard right constituency. There is a McCain constituency, particularly with national security conservatives. And Graham's his best friend, so he wasn't going to abandon Graham. Now that Graham's out, he's free to endorse somebody. And they're both close to Kelly Ayotte, and she might be a kingmaker in New Hampshire, where she's from. So some people think, I think it's probably certainly the case, they want to stop Trump or Cruz for all the foreign policy reasons you laid out. They are hawks. They're interventionists. They don't want to go down.
Romney could endorse Rubio or somebody up there.
And foreign policy-wise, he's definitely with the Graham-McCain wing. So they all could go together.
And endorsements don't matter much anymore, but at the right time, at the right place, it could show consolidation around a candidate and shore up support. So, I mean, typically I don't think endorsements matter much, but sometimes they might. So
I think it'll backfire. I mean, in this case, it might seem like the establishment's going one way. We hate the establishment. Let's vote somebody else.
Yeah.
But
at some point you just have to own that, right? I mean, if you want the establishment lane, then you just have to take the bad with the good, right? I mean,
so in one hand, they could go with Rubio if they think Rubio is the hot hand, best chance to stop Cruz or Trump from getting the nomination. Clearly in sync with them foreign policy wise. So let's go with who's our most electable shot, kind of like Ted Kennedy going with Barack Obama in 2008. But I do recall, particularly Graham, was not happy with Marco Rubio during the immigration debate in 2013. They thought Rubio was fair weather. I mean, Graham said stuff on the record criticizing Rubio for abandoning the bill that he helped negotiate. So if that's still sticking in their craw, and we did see there was, you know, Jeb actually had drinks with McCain and Graham in New Hampshire last week with a photo they put up on Bush's Twitter feed. Bush might have the inside track there. I mean, I don't think they'd go with Bush too soon and have that endorsement be wasted. But if Bush was making gains, maybe they want to put him over the top in New Hampshire towards the end.
Yeah, it could be weird. Maybe they divide. Maybe Romney backs Rubio and McCain and Lindsey back Jeb or something. I mean, and that's indicative of the problem right now, which is that the establishment lane is dividing up their votes, and it feels like Cruz and Trump clearly are the two in the.
But that's a divide too. I mean, you don't have consolidation on either side right now.
No, but I think that it's splintered. Well, number one, it seems like there are a lot more of the populist grassroots votes than the establishment votes out there now, at least in these early primary states. And then secondly, it's, you know, the Republican sort of establishment is dividing it. They're splintered by like five people, whereas I think that the grassroots populist wing. Is really, really now consolidating around two possibilities. That's how it seems to me.
Well, I mean, it's literally what it is right now. My point from the beginning has been the establishment historically unites and the right remains divided. The purists right. have a hard time being strategically doing strategic consolidation. They stick to who they love. And the establishment tends to be more pragmatic and go with who is their best shot to unite around. I'm gonna stick with history, gonna stick with Jeb. But to shift gears before we have to wrap things up. I had a piece in a Real Clear Politics yesterday, which conservative readers did not cotton to, that argued that Obama has broken the second term curse. You go back 40 years. Anyone who's been a second-term president has had a major scandal midway through their second term. Nixon didn't even survive his second term because of Watergate. Then Reagan had Iran-Contra at the tail end of 1986. You had then Bill Clinton had Lewinsky and the impeachment. And then George Bush was hit by Katrina at the end of 2005. And then Iraq bogged him down, which is not quite a scandal, more a policy failure, which led to him losing the Congress in 2006.
I think scandal is the wrong way of looking at this, because Obama did have scandals, but he's had a very productive second term that wasn't bogged down, and in the other case, a lot of the other cases that wasn't.
You either say Obama did not have any kind of real scandal, which is the liberal take, or the conservative take is we had real scandals, but the media didn't cover it properly. Either way, he was not staggered or derailed by his quote unquote scandals. He managed to stay on track with he has an oppositional Congress. He can't get everything he wants, but he certainly pocketed a fair amount of wins over the past few years. You go back to 2013 with the repeal of the Bush tax cuts for the wealthy, staring down Republicans with a shutdown in 2013. This year you have the Iran deal, you have the climate deal, the omnibus bill is considered largely a win for Obama, has some big Obama priorities in there, funding the Paris climate deal for one thing, and a lot of low-income tax credits that would make permanent aspects of the stimulus in 2009. So, you know, you know, second terms are never as good as first terms, but as far as second terms go, this is a pretty gangbuster second term compared to what we've seen in the past. So I got a lot of flack from conservatives in my email and on Twitter saying, you know, well, this just shows that the liberal media is compliant, or some people say this shows how Paul Ryan is compliant. Well, you know, whatever. I mean, I'm not saying I buy the arguments there, but you still want to look at what did this guy do that the other ones didn't to have a good second term? What you can always learn from your opponents. Clearly, the guy did something.
Oh yeah,
right.
No, I remember Bill. I remember you could. This is available somewhere, and we did an inauguration show or a post inauguration show where I was like, you know, second terms are always horrible. I mean, you get Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky, even Reagan, you know, even Reagan had Iran-Contra, George. I mean, just this is by far, you're going to say no drama Obama. Now, look, I mean, the world isn't a mess. The country's a mess. His popularity isn't necessarily high, but he just sort of quietly gets stuff done and does basically what he wants to do. He basically finds a way to do, and there's not a lot of, you know, I mean, yeah, I think that clearly he's figured out a way to, I mean, it's the no drama thing really kind of is the way to define it. I mean,
I think there's three prongs to that. The no drama kind of comes into play in a number of ways. Number one, in scandal management, to the extent that there have been scandals, things like the IRS or Benghazi or the Secret Service or healthcare.gov, you know, either he is, well, in all cases, I think they're very good at getting their facts straight and giving those facts to the media so their story gets told and it's not a one-sided story. So they do that well. Number two, when somebody is compromised, They usually whack them pretty quickly. You know, they got, I mean, Eric Shinseki, who was, you know, pretty golden child in Democratic circles in the VA. When VA got too hot, he was gone.
And with real credentials,
yeah,
as a veteran as well. I mean,
yeah,
not just like politically, but yeah.
Secret Service chair was gone too. There's some lesser things like there was some sort of flyover of New York City. They got people freaked out that it was a terrorist attack. Like, that guy got fired. The GSA had excessive expenses for office parties. That guy got whacked. You know, they don't let those things metastasize.
So Bush famously was loyal, right? You're doing a heck of a job, Brownie. So are you saying one of the lessons to learn here is presidents should have a very short leash when people become problematic or embarrassment? You cut them immediately. Do not let them linger, and do not double down and defend people out of loyalty. Just get the toxins out of the body immediately.
I mean, generally yes, but then you have this other example.
Doesn't embolden? Don't people smell blood? Doesn't that embolden?
You have this other example of healthcare.gov where they did not do that. I mean, Sabeas was eased out later, but their initial impetus was don't panic. Solve the problem first, work through the issue, be patient. You know, again, it's another asset of no drama. And then once the ship got right, then they let her go out on more favorable and calmer terms. And part of that was they didn't want people to feel like they were on the chopping block at the drop of a hat. So there's calibration there as far as when to pull the trigger. And they went overboard in the first term with Shirley Sherrod, or Sherrod, who was a victim of a hit job,
right?
And the left was very mad at Obama for being too obsequious to whatever the right was saying. So, you know, there's need for calibration, but there certainly requires very strict attention to the potential of being overwhelmed by a scandal and making sure you have a game plan for containing whatever comes your way. So I think those two aspects of it are very key. And the third part of it is, as far as, you know, getting that's as far as maintaining your political viability. Then there's how do you get what you want, especially when you don't have Congress that is of the same party. And, you know, throughout the first term, you know, the left was always complaining that Obama was trying too hard to break bread with the right, whether it was even in the first part where Democrats were in control, when the second part of the first term Republicans took over. There's always a complaint that, why are you trying to deal with these guys? These guys, they hate you. They want to destroy you. There's no common ground to be have there. You know, you're wasting your time. You're making yourself look weak. Well, there are a number of occasions where he has gotten what he wants from congressional Republicans. It's taken a long time. It's really not everything he would want, but you can't get everything that you want when you don't control Congress. So I think he has a strategy of, let's see what I can get. Let's identify some goals. Let's talk to people quietly. Let's not negotiate in public, and let's see what we can do in the weeds of things. And what I can't get, then I'll go executive order. But I'm not going to go executive order on everything, because that stuff's susceptible to court challenge and could get overturned by the next president. So legislation first, and don't succumb to the naysayers. You might get more than you think if you try and if you're willing to trade. You know, they got a 5-year extension of wind and solar tax credits, which is very key, because to this point they've been kind of extended on a year by year basis. And it's always kind of down to the wire. And so the industry is always saying, I can't plan 5 years from now because I don't know what the game's going to be. This is always up in the air, and it's really frustrating for our investors. They solved that problem in this last spending bill in exchange for lifting the crude oil export ban. And how damaging is that to the climate? People debate. The Obama people say, look, it's kind of a nothing burger with the way oil prices are right now. So we got the better of that deal. Whatever you think of it, the point is they were willing to deal. They were willing to find a way to get what they want and compromise. So I think you have that going for them as well. They put aside the punditry and actually talked to the players to see what they could do.
Indeed. Well, they should, whoever the next president is, ought to study history, and especially if they get a second term. And I think Obama, I'm guessing Obama did that, right? I mean, I seem to recall that hearing or reading somewhere that they had taken this challenge very seriously of having a second term that doesn't get bogged down, and clearly they learned something.
No, I mean, in some cases, you know, with, say maybe Reagan, I don't know if Reagan had, he got tax reform in 86. That was the big thing in the first part of a second term. And I don't get the sense, and maybe a Reagan historian can correct me, I wouldn't call myself a super Reagan expert. I didn't get the sense that he had that much of a domestic agenda for the second part of the second term. And the biggest thing that
what gets blamed for each of these, there's a theory behind each of these second terms that went awry. And the theory with the Reagan second term, and by the way, a lot of great stuff happened in the second term, but in terms of the Iran-Contra part, the theory is that, you know, when you're first elected, you bring in your friends and the guys who got you there, you know, the top flight political operatives. And by the second term, you're down to your third string, fourth string spokesman or whatever, and that kind of happened with Reagan, and the Reagan James Baker trade. Was that right? Was it Don Regan went to be chief
Regan
of staff?
Okay. I know Regan got forced out in the second term.
I think there was a swap where James Baker, who was a really shrewd political operator, had managed George H.W. Bush's campaign and was Reagan's first chief of staff. I believe he left to become Treasury Secretary. And I think Reagan left that to, they swapped jobs. I think it was Reagan. Anyway, so now Reagan has a chief of staff who doesn't really know Reagan and who isn't keeping an eye on the store. I mean, that is essentially the Reader's Digest version of what the narrative, that's what happened to Reagan's second. To the Iran-Contra.
But after Iran-Contra, he had a big poll drop. This was around the turn of the new year, 87. And so they were really caught up with that for several months in 87. By the fall of 87, the big thing he wanted to accomplish was to place Robert Bork on the court. And you had a Democratic Senate at this point. You had Reagan at some of his weaker poll numbers. Democrats were juiced to block that nomination, which they did. You know, it's theoretical, but you know, if Iran-Contra didn't happen, would have been easier to get Bork passed because Reagan would have had approval ratings in the 60s or 70s and would have been able to press his case better. So I think there was some actual, you know, specific damage that occurred to his legacy because of that. Now, he still got the nuclear arms treaty with Gorbachev after Iran-Contra. In fact, there was an argument that they were eager to get that, to get Iran-Contra off the front pages and have a win. But they didn't have a domestic agenda, I think, to fill the space. You know, Clinton had more of a domestic agenda to try to fill the space with. It wasn't terribly ambitious in the second term, but I think they were able to compartmentalize a little bit better. And Obama, I think, set out goals every single year, maintained a public media presence every single year. They were very cognizant that they had to kind of work extra hard to get less in a second term than the first because of you're fighting against the current in your second term. So having that game plan, having that strategy, I think is pretty critical. You can't just sort of leave it to the winds when so much momentum is moving away from you.
Indeed. All right, Bill. Well, Merry Christmas, Happy Holidays to all of you out there in the northern and southern, eastern, western DMZ.
One month to fail?
1 month. That comes out January 26th. Pre-order now on Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, BooksAMillion.com, wherever fine books are sold. If you've not done that yet, please do that ASAP. We need to plan out our Christmas schedule, our New Year's schedule. And,
well, I probably need to take a breather for the final week. I might have to see you in the new year.
Yeah, and then I'm going to be out on book leave, you know. I'm gonna need you to sort of hold down the fort promoting the book while I'm out shamelessly promoting it on the hustings. So,
Where the tour is going to take you?
Well, okay, so initially we debated me going to Iowa, but initially the strategy is honestly to stay in the D.C. area for D.C. or New York. The book's going to launch in New York, be up there to do TV probably the 26th, 27th, 28th. Then I'll be in D.C. for the next couple weeks. So when Iowa and New Hampshire is going, I'm going to be around here. It's actually not till March when I'm going to be doing an actual book tour. Just a few select locations, and somewhat random. But I'll be in places, allegedly I'll be in places including Syracuse, New York, Salt Lake City, Utah, Phoenix, Arizona, and, Las Vegas, Nevada. Those are on my schedule now, places for me to go and speak. I will be speaking also, if you're in the DC area, at the Leadership Institute's Wednesday Wake Up Breakfast. That's the first Wednesday in February. I think if you sign up early, it's $5. You can have breakfast and hear me talk about the book if you can get up at 7:30 a.m. So I'll keep you guys posted on all that fun stuff. But it's getting exciting, Bill. We're getting down to crunch time now.
Well, if plans change in February and they do ask you to come to New Hampshire, you let me know. I'm only an hour away. So,
yeah, well, I mean, it would make a certain amount of sense, you know, to do something up there with the book. So, and when is syrup season, Sugar Shack season?
Sugar Shack season is gonna, well, you know, it's such a warm winter right now. I'm not even quite sure we're gonna have a maple syrup season, but typically that starts in early March where the sap starts to flow.
Well, maybe that's an argument to go up there after the primary, you know.
I don't see why it's an either or. I mean, you really should come up as much as possible.
All righty.
Great Christmas.
Merry Christmas. God bless you each and everyone. Do order the book. And thank you for your support throughout the years. We appreciate it.
See you in 2016.
Thanks for listening to Blogging Heads TV. You can help support this content by remembering to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can subscribe to all Blogging Heads episodes or to a specific program by going to our subscribe page at bloggingheads.tv/subscribe. There you can sign up for podcast downloads via iTunes or Stitcher, or you can subscribe to our email and we'll send you an alert every time we post a new episode.